Thank you for coming here. I'm sure we're going to have a lot more people coming in as they walk off the meal at the Spaghetti House. Want to thank our guest, Len Lord, for coming. And I want to thank his friend, Rusty Burke, for acting as moderator with this. They've got approximately an hour, and as is our custom here at FolkCon, they are allowed to run the program however they want to while they're online. Thank you very much. It's up to you.
And boy, if there's anything Glenn needs, it's moderator.
How about an agitator?
All right, well, I want to start off with a simple question. How did a nice kid from Pelican, Louisiana get involved with pulp magazines in the first place?
Pulp magazines I finally ran through when I was going to school at Alexandria, Louisiana. Someone had bought some plant stories and I borrowed on them. So I started to go buying plant stories in FFM and FN off the stands when I could afford them, which was very seldom at the time. I lived out in the country and needless to say, I didn't have a whole lot of money. I still don't have a whole lot of money before that goes.
What were your favorites early on?
You mean
in the pulse, what were your favorite writers?
Oh, I liked Poole Anderson and Ray Bradbury and others of that ilk.
How did you discover Robert E. Howard?
That's a long story.
Good, I'll sit back here and tell you.
It depends on your point of view. You can credit it to, or if you prefer, blame it on a guy named Bradford M. Day from South Ozone Park, New York. I was corresponding with him. Day was a fan, a small town publisher, and a sometime bookseller. When I moved to Pasadena, Texas, and got a job, I could afford more books, so he started selling books. And he recommended the Arkham House, Skullface, and others. At that time, Arkham House was kind of in bad shape, I think. They were selling their books at a discount. I got Skullface for $4, which is not a bad price, I suppose, nowadays. So I read it, and I liked it. So I started looking for other Robert E. Howard stuff. The only thing available at that time was the Norm Press Conan the Conqueror. Then I got invited, if you want to call it that, to the United States Army. So I wound up in Korea. That's what you call a Korea in the Army. And so I was 52 and part of 53, most of 53 in fact. So I came back to the United States and I found out that the pulp magazines had just about all disappeared off the stands. So at that time I read a couple of the Arkham House poetry collections, you know, Carcassian Smith, Hornbook for Witches by Leopold Dean Drake. I liked the looks of those books, and I had seen some Howard poetry in Dark of the Moon by August Derleth. And I liked Howard's poetry, so I thought, well, it'd be a great idea if somebody were to collect the Howard poetry, put it in book form. So I got permission from Oscar Friend, who was a Howard agent, and I managed to collect the published poetry out of Weird Tales and a few fanzines. Donald Waldheim got a collection this year. poems out of Alden American Poetry Department and American Poet out of the New York Public Library. And I went to Cross Plains thinking, I went to Brownwood thinking that the Howard Main University Library would have a Robert E. Howard collection. Well, that was just a myth as far as that goes. Regardless of what the yearbooks used to say. There was a guy named Dr. Thomas M. Havens there. He gave me a copy of the Howard poem, The Tempter. And I ran across a guy named, Bill Chambers, I believe it was, in May, Texas. He was a, a former veterinary, but he had a son named Norris Chambers, who had been connected with Howard at one time. Norris Chambers, it turned out, had a few unpublished Howard poems, so I got those through my good friend Dale Hart, and we include that in Always Comes Evening. My first idea was to publish Always Comes Evening myself, but I found out I couldn't get it published, or I shouldn't say published, I mean printed inbound at a price I could sell it for about $3 for. So Derwitt suggested I send the manuscript to him, and he was into George Benham. George Benham bid on it, and it was a pretty good price. But Derwitt told me that Benham would not accept a new customer. So he suggested that I, send a book to them and let them publish it as an Arkham House book. When that book sold, then I would get a certain percentage of the money on each sale. So I'd give them money back, I'd pay it out for the rights. I don't know if I ever came out even or not, and I never checked it out. Somewhere close to being even, I guess. I think 636 copies of Weird have always come to Eden and published. I think it's $800-something for all 636 copies. The last 100 copies were labeled on the spine correctly. They put the labeling on the spine on all the other copies backwards. That's not terribly important, I don't think. I understand the copy is worth about $600 nowadays in good shape. That's a little bit better than buying stock.
And I live directly to the Callow Youth from Pasadena, Texas, being the agent. How did that come about?
Thank you. Starting in 61, I started the Howard Collector, which is a small fanzine. I based the title on Ray Zorn's The Lovecraft Collector. Oscar Friend had died recently, and his widow and his daughter, Kitty Friend, were closing the agency down. So the Kirkendalls, I'm talking about Mrs. Fiam Kirkendall and Allery Morris, her daughter, had asked her to get a professional agent. They had asked L. Sprague DeCamp to be the agent, but DeCamp didn't want to do that. He had other businesses he wanted to fool with. And he suggested me, since I had more or less had an interest in Howard. So I took it on, even though I didn't know anything about being an agent. That was in 65. I had the good fortune, I guess it was, of making the air something like about $2.5 million net in the time I was agent. Okay.
Well, you had to get assignments from short stories till I been in the business, because somebody was suggesting that maybe theirs didn't have the rights to the common stories, right? So you had to go looking for assignments to protect them.
If you mean the comments, that was later on in the comments survey. That was just before that.
Was that your candidate?
That was just before the formation of Conan Properties.
Oh, okay. Well, tell us about the formation of Conan Properties.
I don't know if any of you are familiar with L. Sprague de Camp. I'm sure you are. I had a lot of problems with the man, I have to say. He claimed he had all rights just to the corn stores, or that's a Republic domain. He had checked out with the Library of Congress on the titles of the individual stores, and of course there wasn't anything listed on those titles. So Kirby McCauley, who was helping me, suggested that I go down and check the copyright books on Weird Tales, not just the title of the story. So I checked the copyright books on Weird Tales and found out some of them had been renewed by Steinberg Press, some by Blanket Press, and others. So I got an assignment. I think I paid $10 for an assignment for the Conan stories that had been renewed. That's not all the Conan stories were renewed, just some of them. Of course, there were some Conan stories that were in good shape, like the ones that the camp turned in the Conan stories for Norm Press in 1955. And there was a story like The Right Stranger and God in the Bowl. Those were in good copyrights from good shape.
Of course, in the 1950s, Oscar Friend had made Dr. Kirkendall an offer that it turned out he could refuse, right?
Mm-hmm. I think Dr. Kirkendall had made an offer to sell the Conan stories to Oscar Friend, but it wasn't a terrific lot of money. But Oscar Friend had kept cutting the price he was offering, willing to pay. So finally, Dr. Kirkendall thought he would just continue as it was going. Noam Press, by the way, owed the Howard Ayers quite a bit of money whenever Marty Greenberg decided to shut Noam Press down. And by the way, we never did get the money.
What was it that Friend had offered Dr. Kirkendall? Was about $1,250 or something?
I think about $1,250.
That's for all the rights of the comic stories. Which, as Clint said, ended up making about $2 million. Well, go ahead and tell us, I mean, one of the great stories that you've been involved in is your detective work in finding a box of the Howard manuscripts. What's about tracking that down?
Yeah, I'll start about after the publication of all the films, I finally found E. Hoffman Price in Redwood City, California. I went out there in 1961, visited him, and I asked him if he had any of our stuff. He gave me a roll of microfilm as a poetry on it that R.H. Barlow had made when the Druid Press was looking at the idea of publishing Howard poetry. So Price told me he thought he had a box full of tear sheets, is what he called them, that Dr. Kirkendall had seen. He said, well, I think I loaned them to a guy named Stuart Boland. So he said, I'll write Boland and ask him to send them to you. He wrote Boland. Boland was in South America at the time. But he replied, he came back and said, well, I gave the box to Francis T. Laney.
only trouble was Blaney had died just recently. So I more or less forgot about it. Wouldn't make any difference anyway, just tear sheets. But when I became agent, I got all of the Oscar Freeman records, and there was an inventory of stories made by apparently Otis Klein. They were titled I had never heard of, so I got to thinking, well, maybe those weren't just tear sheets, maybe they were manuscripts. So I wrote to Boland and I asked him if he could help me find him that box of tear sheets or manuscripts, whatever they are. So offered money. That was that perfect offer, because Boland immediately said when he told me he just ran across a lady named Dominica G, who was Francis T. Laney had hired to read typewritten manuscripts. That's a job I wouldn't want, by the way. And I didn't believe him when the word go, but he didn't give me a name, just Dominica G. But anyway, he gave me a price, and I paid him a few $100, and I got a box full of manuscripts. On total, I got about 3 boxes of manuscripts, and I finally got all the letters to H.P. Lovecraft that Boland also had. So I suspect that I paid Boland something like $1,000 altogether for all that stuff.
Do you know how much material you've got there? How many stories, poems, and so how many pages?
Well, it's several reams anyway, for sure. If you can imagine somebody taking a front end loader and dumping about 10 reams of loose papers, into a box, you can figure what kind of job I had sorting all this stuff out.
So it took you about a week, right?
Yeah.
How many hours have you spent on the photocopier sending copies to people like me?
You mean you?
Or my friends in Paris.
Yeah. Oh, probably 30 minutes.
When it comes to Robert E. Howard, though, do you have favorite stories and characters?
Oh, I like Breckenridge Elkins. I like Solomon Kane. And I like Hull also, even though most of the stories are not really fantasy except in the setting.
Any particular stories of those characters you like best?
Oh, the Mirrors of Two and Seven, Skulls and the Stars. I like well, it's just difficult to say. I like so many different ones. You know, I like the historical also. The Soul of the Thunder, a Shadow of the Vulture, the Line of Tiberius.
What appeals to you about him?
I like it. The vivid action and the feeling in the stories. There's no boredom to the stories. You're into the story immediately if you're reading it.
Leaving aside the Conan, because we know that publishing was already sort of underway by the time you became the agent. As the agent, what were your goals with regard to Robert E. Howard?
Well, the goals for the heirs was to make them some money, because they'd only made something like in the previous time between 37, that's the year after Howard died, and 65 when I became agent, they had received something like maybe $6,000 gross in royalties I'm talking about all the heirs. I'm talking about Dr. Howard, Dr. Kurgadal, and Mrs. Kurgadal, who, of course, received the monies from Dr. Kurgadal when he died.
But when you went to set it up, trying to get Howard Word published, what was your, did you have a game plan, or did people approach you? Did you go seeking them out?
I just went seeking them out. I was lucky, I suppose. I found the Robert W. Lyons magazine, East Magazine of Horror. I submitted some manuscripts to them, and I put together a book of short stories and submitted them to Lancer Books. That was Wolfhead and others. And I put together the Brainerd Moore stories, and I submitted that to Lancer Books, but the editor at Lancer went to Dale, and he took the book with him. It was my blessing. And so that's why it's a Dale book.
Somebody was asking, what's your opinion of the pastiches and the unauthorized continuations and other publications now?
Can I do it this way?
Y'all weren't there at Howard Days last year. Glenn was on a panel with Roy Thomas, and somebody asked him what his opinion was of the First Coming comic, and he said, well, it didn't make me vomit. And David and Morgan were talking last night about this. When you put together the book of Robert E. Howard and the second book of Robert E. Howard for Zero, did you have a grand plan in mind for those?
Just a sort of a sampler of different Robert E. Howard stories.
Did you pick them because the stories themselves appealed to you, or just because they represented a range, or hadn't been published?
Well, some of each.
I'll ask y'all if you have any questions. Jump in here.
Do you have any stories about Howard and yourself with Marcus Gillis and Mark?
Do you have any questions, or do you have any stories about August Ehrlich and Arkham House and you and Howard? You know, than all this comes even.
Well, no, I got along with Ehrlich pretty well. He treated me pretty fairly. I suppose one of the last stories that August Ehrlich ever completed was The House in the Oaks. That was an unfinished manuscript, and he completed it. And then he went home and died, you might say, because he died very shortly thereafter.
So, how did Zebra come about to be such a major publisher of Howard during the 70s?
Kirby McCauley was in touch with Zebra. Funny thing about it, the president, the head of Zebra was a guy named Walter Zacharias, who had been president of Lancer Books. And also the editor at Zebra was a lady who had worked for Lancer Books. So I suppose they knew about Howard from Lancer Books.
What do you think of the whole wide world, and
how do you think it depicted Robert E. Howard? I think it's a good movie.
You think D'Onofrio caught the essence of Howard?
Fairly well. I tell you this, though. When Novlin first wrote One Who Walked Alone, I sent it to Donald Grant. And Grant sent it back saying, I like it, but it's too much about Novlin and not enough about R.E.H. So I asked her to rewrite it. With some trepidation, she did so, and that was what was published.
Do
his movie then were students of hers, and so now the complaint that we sometimes hear online is that there's too much of novel and not enough of variation. And I'm like, well, it's told from her point of view.
Yeah, the title is "We Walk Alone," so you know, it's kind of our number one world.
Any other questions?
Yeah. In your working career, did you have anything to do with Seabrook Quinn?
No. I did write to Quinn once. That's going to be a different correspondent with Howard, but he was by the head now. I think he died not too long after then.
69.
Seth Price, were there any of the other Weird Tales authors that you had much dealings with?
I used to know Kirk Mashburn. That was one of Lee Hoffman Price's closest friends. He lived in Houston. That's the only Weird Tale writer or anything you deal with, I guess.
What was Kirk like?
Oh, he was kind of a quiet guy. He had a bad case of emphysema, I believe it was. And that's what killed him. But he was also a pain in the head, kind of like Price, but wasn't quite so blunt about some things. Price would tell you that you're a wage slave because you work for a living. And he had other strong opinions about everything. So I won't repeat.
So he and Clyde Smith might have got along pretty good.
Possibly. Clyde Smith didn't think much of the camp.
Clyde Smith said was a pretty strong opinion that he died, from what I gather.
Yes.
Tell us about your first meeting with Clyde.
Terry Clyde Smith.
Tell us about your first meeting with him. Tell us about your first meeting with Clyde Smith.
I came to Brownwood and I called him up a couple of times. And finally, he went into the phone. And finally, I got an invitation to come to his house. And I talked to him briefly. After that, though, he started calling me on the phone. So it wasn't too long before he got kind of friendly. Even though he had a box full of letters to from Lee Howard, he never told me about those. It was only after his death that his nephew, Roy Barkley, found the letters and told me about them.
You met David Lee, too, right?
Yeah.
One of his best friends. What was David Lee like?
Just a big, quiet guy. He told me, I asked him about the Howard rumored collision of the flagpole and rising star. He said, yeah, I was one of them. He named the other guys who were with him. So I guess there was a collision of the flagpole.
But Howard might have exaggerated it just a little bit.
Yeah, well, yeah, he exaggerated nearly everything he did.
And Lindsay Tyson, you met him, got along with too, right?
Oh, yes.
So all three of Robert's best friends up there you met.
Yes.
I think you're one of the few people that day. Howard came to me that day way before he died.
I think, let's see, Howard Roller must have made.
Yes,
When did the town of Cross Plains really start to recognize the celebrity value of power and start to take advantage of that?
I'm not quite sure exactly when, but I guess it must have been about in the 80s. Is that when they bought the Howard House?
Yeah.
But about the 8 years when they bought the Howard House. The Howard House had just been sitting there and all growing up with ivy on the side of the building. They have restored it pretty well and got period furniture in it. It's pretty nice now. It's made it kind of a museum out of it.
Were you out there watering it down when the fire started?
Oh, no.
The next door neighbor was literally out there with his garden hose watering it down to before the fire department got here.
Do they get a lot of visitors besides on Howard days?
Yep.
So throughout the year?
If you're ever in Cross Plains and there's a number on the side of the house that you can call, and somebody will come down and show you around. They've had just after Howard days, Bruce Boxleitner, the actor, was at a rodeo in Abilene and decided to make the side trip over and turn out his big house.
Okay, I got a two-fold question for Glenn. Glenn, from the time you started working on Always Comes Evening in the 50s to the time that Clark Ashton Smith died in the 60s, did you ever contact him via letter or telephone?
Call my Smith?
Clark Ashton Smith, yeah.
I'm with you. I visited him in 1959.
In Auburn?
Pacific Grove.
Oh, Pacific Grove.
Yeah, I went to his house and there was a sign on the wall that says, warning, artists at work, do not knock or ring before 6 p.m. I wasn't about to drive all the way back to Texas, I'd drive all the way to California. So I knocked. The dragon lady, if I can use that term, came to the door. Smith was behind her. I said, I'm the guy who compile the Arkham House tradition, Always Comes Evening. So she invited me in. So I got to talk, visit with Smith. She went back upstairs with somebody else. Smith was kind of an uncommunicative sort of person. He was quite a quiet guy. I found out that the book at Arkham House had announced at one time that it was supposed to be an inventory of Smith's carvings. He was supposed to have been working on that, but it never came out. I don't know why. And I wish I had bought a Smith's carving while I was there, but I didn't.
A dual friend of ours, Dan Gott, has the rejection letter that Howard got from Thrills of the Jungle. He says Hersey's sort of a pet project of mine. I found that kind of interesting that Hersey sent back his story. Are there a lot of rejection letters left in the Howard estate?
Oh, not sure. There was a bunch of them. 20 or 30 maybe all together in the box of a material I got from Boland.
What was the magazine, do you recall?
The magazine?
The magazine that rejected Howard.
Weird Tales.
Oh, Weird Tales, and of course, MacFadden Publications was one rejection, and he got rejected by the Surly Group several times, Legal Marketers. He got rejected by A.H. Bittner of RSC.
That's my favorite rejection letter. Says it's real simple. It just says, "Dear Mr. Howard, The Night of the Wolf is a lot too vague and slow moving for RSC." If you ever read The Night of the Wolves, and then you read the Argus, a Fred McIsaac story, you're like, what?
The Black Bear Bike was rejected by Taurus and Benji.
Yeah. I'm back there.
You know, in Hollywood, Arnold Schwarzenegger made a very
our parent. Were you involved in the negotiations on that?
No. Me, get out.
Were you involved in movie negotiations, getting the movie done?
No, I believe when did most of that. That was the attorney for Cohen Properties.
Because the movie led directly to the formation of Cohen Properties, right?
Yeah, that was the idea for the formation, so there wouldn't be any dissent among the rights owners, so they could negotiate with the movie company with one face. Speaking of Father Lou, when that reminds me, he was a Jewish lawyer, in case you can tell by his name. He visited Schwarzenegger at his apartment or home. And when he walked in, Arnold was playing Hitler speeches on his loudspeaker. Trying to make Arnold feel it, Lieberman feel at home, I guess.
7 months of negotiations.
Scott?
Speaking of negotiations, Glenn, what part did you take in the Lancer negotiations?
Lancer? Actually, none. That was DeGamp.
So you didn't work as agent to coordinate any kind of monies? Or he had all the properties, he had all the negotiating what rights, or they didn't go through you guys at all?
Well, the accountant did that on his own.
Right.
However, when I got ready to sell the comic book rights, I went ahead and sold them. I didn't talk to the camp or answer either one about that. Because I had to give it in rights.
How did you get the comic book rights going?
Well, Laurie Thomas had written a letter asking if it would be possible to get rights to the character for the comic books for Marvel. I said, sure. So that's who I dealt with.
And he offered you a vast amount of money, right?
Well, not exactly a vast amount, but better than nothing.
How do you think the comics affected the popularity of the Powers were?
Well, I'm sure there's people here who don't care for them, but they helped somewhat.
Did you see a big boost in people requesting rights to the Howard stories, or a little bit, or none?
A little bit.
When you look around at the state of Howard Publishing today, do you have any thoughts on that?
It seems to be coming back very strongly. It's one thing is not being messed up by a bunch of pesties. At least most of the books that are working nowadays are authentic Howard. It doesn't, somebody else has written and stuck in there with it. Like the Gambit and Carter did with the Conan stories and so forth.
Are there any particular illustrators in Howard that you are?
Oh, I like Gianni, I like, of course, Rosetta. And there are others also.
I suppose.
No.
Any other questions out there? But
who handles the rights to the Howard,
a young lady named Lee Stone in Paradox Entertainment that is the licensing manager and handles all of that.
The Howard Estate has been sold, of course, Corner Properties too, has been sold to Paradox Entertainment.
Yeah, they first bought Common Properties, and then later they bought Robert Howard Properties, so they own all of Robert Howard's first under one umbrella now. They're mainly, again, they're a licensing company, so they're primarily interested in role-playing games and movies and the like. And they last year approached me and Paul Herman about creating a nonprofit foundation, the Robert Howard Foundation, to put a fire out there. To work with getting most of Robert Howard's work into print, but also to promote scholarship of Robert, you know, with Robert Howard studies, to try to get all of his work back into print, to promote Howard Days and Project Pride at the Robert Howard Museum. So they were really instrumental in helping set up this nonprofit foundation that would try to advance the state of Robert Howard studies. But they recognized, part of it is that they said they recognized that their expertise was in licensing and films and money making stuff, not publishing. Do you have any other thoughts you want to share with people about Paul's pulp collecting and something this crowd might be interested in?
You might be interested in the various countries where there have been Howard publications. He's been published in several editions in Brazil. He has appeared in Argentina briefly. He has appeared in Japan, naturally. In Turkey, Bulgaria, Romania, Estonia, Croatia, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Hungary, Italy, Germany, Belgium, France, Netherlands, Spain, just about all of Europe except Austria and Switzerland.
Yeah, I thought you once asked me for if I know anybody who's in Greece.
Yeah, he appeared in Greece also.
Which reminds me, do we have anybody here who knows Russian? Because Glenn's got a Russian book, but he wants to know what the title is.
Which foreign language editions have sold the best?
Which foreign language editions have sold the best?
I don't know. Sure.
They didn't always provide loyalty statements, I think. But he's really popular in some countries. Morgan said there used to be a lot of Robert Howard in Russia, right?
Used to be, but when I was there, not so much now. Moscow, December, there's nothing.
Oh, you're here in St. Petersburg, you can go to Severo Zavala Press. That's the Northwest Press in St. Petersburg. They have published an edition of Kohan, K-O-H-A-H, in Cyrillic. That's K-O-N-A-N, if you're in English, alphabet. They have something like 130-something titles on the list so far. That's hardbacks, about 300-something pages each one.
And all Robert Howard material, right?
Oh, no. Most of it is written under English names, like Olive Blackman or some Wayne Wright. You can just about pick any kind of name you want, and they have used them.
Tom, did you have a question, or are you cutting something?
Just give me five more.
Okay. Speaking of Pulse, I know that for a while you were thinking about working on an index to fight stories, or maybe the Fiction House magazines, but you gave that up.
No, I'm giving it up, just sort of retiring it for the time being.
So, Tom?
Is there a gratification in seeing all the material off the type Chris Howard wrote it with the one in Starbucks and the other editions that come out where they no longer have an editor's hand on it?
you feel any gratification in seeing stuff that comes directly from the time scripts as opposed to being heavily edited?
Yes, but of course we don't have manuscripts or time scripts for some of the stories. Because, you know, most of the magazines, pub magazines, they would just destroy the manuscript until they reset the material.
Do you recall which fanzine you read about it down the earth?
I don't recall which one I've heard rumors, strong rumors that Orange was right, completely down there.
It was in some fanzine. I remember you telling me that you'd seen it in some fanzine that there was a first draft of Tale of the Synopsis, which Howard did frequently. And then
yeah.
the beginning of the second draft, and then the synopsis. But of course, most of us don't think chapter 12 is really
the right. The hour agent's records don't indicate who they completed it. Obviously, it wasn't Otis Klein because he was taking his cut, and he was sure if he did. Oscar Friend didn't show anything, so we took his cut too.
Or, I guess John had his.
Glenn, did you have any opinion about the editing John Grant did on the Solomon Kane and some of the other ones concerning racism and power? And did you feel he shouldn't have taken that out? Or?
I didn't know that had happened. I don't think he should have bothered with it.
What do you feel about the controversy that sort of brewed that apparently one of the reasons for Howard committing suicide is because he was owed so much money by Farnsworth Bryant?
You know, it depends on whether you want to commit suicide or $800. That's what he would owe, $800-something.
You may have answered this already, and if so, I apologize, but where are the Howard papers today? What existed?
What do you mean with papers?
Are there any manuscripts, letters, and so forth? Are they in a library or a collection somewhere?
I've got most of them.
Oh, yeah, but
I guess you could say it's in my collection.
It's not going to give you the address of the storage. But you have plans for them, don't you?
Yeah, eventually.
Can you tell us?
Eventually.
Maybe I'll put them in a poke on auction. Who knows?
You heard it here first. That's a good reason for people to start attending auctions.
Brett, this is more a question for you. For those of us who have not been across the plains where we could go there, the items in the house and things, are there any of Robert Howard's property or actual items still in the house?
There's a
typewriter or his writing desk, right?
His actual typewriter, no. Allegedly, a collector named Jay Cornett in California owns that typewriter, and he's got a chain of problems. Some people question his controversy, but he supposedly has that. Sprague Camp donated a bust of Cleopatra to Howard's known. Supposedly it was one of Robert's acquisitions from New Orleans when he was 13. A little camel inkwell that a Syrian member of the legislature, he's a merchant who I guess knew the Howards, said he didn't do it longer. There are three framed prints in the living room that belong to the Howards. So there's a few. And then Don Heron last year, through a friend of his, found some of Dr. Howard's books that had been in somebody's attic, and he donated those to Project Pride, and they're sitting in the living room now in a nice little glass front bookcase. So
it's all about recreation, or is it?
There's some authentic stuff in there, and the recreation is really nicely done too. So. I think, you know, anybody who's out can certainly, or all can certainly owe it to themselves.
He did not have an IBM Selectric, by the way.
Pardon?
I said he did not have an IBM Selectric, by the way. Or a computer either.
No, so if you found those typescripts that looked like they were done on Selectric, that was probably one of his transcripts. You were saying earlier you didn't envy that job of the woman making the types, the transcripts, but you made a lot of them yourself.
Yeah. Some cases it would be poor quality carbons. Some cases the paper would be just be torn up.
This is a weird tale, though, and Owen Howard, so much money. Did they do that because they knew he was way down in Texas and wasn't likely to show up at their door with a gun? Or the Klein was right there, and Klein had contacts with Bright. Did Howard ever feel that Klein wasn't doing the job for him up there? How did he get in that deep?
Klein actually, yeah.
Klein was in Chicago.
Yeah, but Howard actually, when he tried to get Augen, he gave some stuff to August Leninger and gave some stuff to, or not Leninger, he talked to Leninger, but he gave some stuff to Copeland, the agent for him, and then Klein got a shirt about it. But Howard was trying to get some other people to agent his stuff. I think he was thinking that maybe Klein wasn't aggressive enough about marketing.
Howard sold the record to do weird deals. He didn't go to an agent.
That's right. Yeah. He sold directly to Fiction House, too, didn't he?
No, I think he went to an agent on Fiction House.
I'm about halfway through Price's Book of the Dead. I just put that off for several years. That's just a terrific book. And Price pretty much comes out and says that weird deals had money and they just weren't paying it. And I just... He says
that's what Price says, and that's what he told Dr. Howard, and Dr. Howard certainly believed that. But, said Price talking, you know. Can you absolutely believe it or not? They owed him a lot of money. It was the Depression, and they owed him a lot of money.
You wouldn't want to pay for sure anything about Ehoff and Vasily.
And also, you know, Don, I know Don was going on and on about the, I probably hated Farnsworth Wright and stuff because they owed him so much money. But you read the correspondence of E.H. Price and H.P. Lovecraft and those guys and Clark Ashton Smith, and man, those guys sandwiched Farnsworth Wright. They just slagged on him right from them. Robbie Howard almost never said anything negative about Farnsworth Wright to these guys. He really didn't bad enough at all, so I don't think Howard really had that hard feeling toward it. I think he wanted his money, and he was upset that he wasn't getting the money that he needed. But mainly because his mother's health, he needed his cash. And so when the letter that he wrote about how badly I needed cash, I mean, that was the time when they were really strapped. His mother needed some immediate medical care, and he needed cash, and they didn't miss the payment. So I don't think that was why he got upset.
If Howard had lived, in what direction do you think he would have gone? Would he have more western?
What direction do you think he would have gone if he lived?
He probably would have started writing western stories much more frequently than he had been. Street and Smith paid him whenever he sold stuff to them. I suspect that was one of the reasons he was willing to go with Street and Smith on westerns or adventure stories. You get a check for Street Smith, you wouldn't get a check from Popular Fiction.
Okay, but we got the high sign. It's time for us to give way to the radio players, I think. That's all.
As is what we've always done every year to our guests, our first-timers, on behalf of Paul Found and everybody here, we want to give this to you in honor of your having been our guest this year.
Okay, thank you.